tonight on Arena. Saxophonist Jess Gilliman bringing her ensemble to the West Wicklow Chamber Music Festival, and new albums from Lewis Cabaldi, Paul Simon and Kesha up for review. Five one double 51 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Next week sees the start of the Blackwater Valley Opera Festival, located at the historical Lismore Castle in County Waterford. This year's central performance will be Verdi's Macbeth, staged in the grounds of the castle, an ideal backdrop for the atmosphere of murder, treachery and ghostly interventions that are involved in the dark world of medieval Scotland that Macbeth brings us to. It brings us on a journey through ambition, guilt and the destructive nature of power. Verdi's music reflects perfectly the psychological turmoil of its characters. Macbeth, the opera, will be conducted by Killian Farrell, directed by Sarah Baxter, all in collaboration with the Irish Chamber Orchestra. Delighted to be joined by Sarah and Killian, along with Goran Juric, who will perform the role of Banquo, who I think is the only nice person, it's probably safe enough to say, in Macbeth. Near enough, the only good guy in both the opera and the play. Let's start with you, Sarah. And the play is the obvious starting point here, because I suppose people are probably more familiar with that story of this ambition of this guy who thinks, I'm going to be the King of Scotland no matter what because the witch has told me. How close is it to the opera and what's the attraction of the opera for you?
Yeah, I mean, the play was the starting point for Verdi as well. He was very inspired by the play, and we've seen that even in the letters that he was writing at around that time. In fact, he wrote to his first Macbeth and Lady Macbeth, he wrote, "Honour the poet over the composer." Yeah. So he was very much tied to the ideas, but he did make it his own. And I think how he did that was really putting certain characters more into focus. So really the opera puts more into focus Macbeth, Lady Macbeth, and also the witches have a very big part in the whole world of it.
Yeah, it really strikes me with the witches, Killian, and this is a musical choice as much as anything else, I guess. Normally the witches, there are three witches, and that's what there are. When shall we three meet again? He risks quoting from the play in the studio. But in the case of the opera, Verdi expands that into a whole chorus of witches.
He does. He made a very deliberate decision not just to have three witches, but to have a whole chorus of evil women singing away, divided into three groups. And he said repeatedly, like what Sarah was saying with his requests to his librettist, the writer who wrote the text for him, he said it's very important that the three main characters in the opera are Macbeth, Lady Macbeth, and the witches. Mm. And because they sing in a group, the music is, it has such a power and such a drive. And it becomes much more easy for them to carry the opera in a sense, as it would be if they were just three witches.
I was tempted at the very first thing we hear, as in the play, is in fact, or is it in the play? Well, any the first thing we hear in the opera as well, the first words we hear are from the mouths of the witches. But they are preceded. There is a prelude at the beginning, which is kind of like an overture, but they are preceded then by a minute of music before they sing, which to me perfectly establishes the atmosphere of Macbeth. Remember, you know, we're in quagmire-y, muddy place, probably there's been a big battle, and out they come with their predictions as to what might happen. But the music that sets it in motion is very atmospheric. So just a little flavour there of the opening chorus from the witches in Verdi's opera Macbeth, which has been staged as part of the main item, of course, in this year's Blackwater Valley Opera Festival. And with me in studio this evening, director of the opera, Sarah Baxter, Killian Farrell, who'll be conducting the orchestra, and Goran Juric, who plays the part of Banquo. And we'll come to Banquo in a moment. But even as that played, Killian, you said, it's really hard, this section, even when you were listening to it on a recording. What makes it so difficult? Is it just to explain to me.
I think the thing that's so difficult about Verdi is that the music is so pure. You have nowhere to hide. It's I think it's like Mozart in that sense. In there are two composers that always wrote so much in earnest, and what every note has a meaning, and there aren't many of them. You know, if you listen to Puccini, if that's or sort of later operas, even Wagner for the German opera, there is just so many, there are so many
There's notes. More happening.
There's more happening. There's so much content. And in Verdi, I think he has distilled all of this and the emotions run so high. And because there is in some way so few places to hide, one has to work really hard to make sure it comes across.
And then, Sarah, you know, you were saying that Verdi's letters to the original, in the original production, to that first cast, he was saying, honor the poet, not the composer.
Yeah.
Is that a good note for the director here as well? Do you have to take your I suppose your lead from the music more than anything else?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that you can use the play as an additional source of information, but you have to work with the opera itself and use the music. And even from what we just heard there, it gives you such a strong sense of kind of the world you want to create and the setting with it, you know. So I would have turned to the music as much as the libretto to kind of inform the ideas that went into the production and in making the characters.
So coming then to you, Goran, and the character of Banquo, I'm wondering about, because we often think Macbeth is the tenor, I'm presuming, and Lady Macbeth, go ahead.
You were almost going to, baritone.
He's a baritone. Because, I saw a production with Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau in it, so I presume he would have been playing Macbeth as a baritone. And Lady Macbeth?
Soprano.
Soprano, she is up
a
there
classic soprano,
at the top. Banquo is a bass.
Yeah, so, that's right.
So are you, as we just heard, even from three words. How does Verdi write for that low register that your voice so clearly has, Joran?
Oh my God, he writes really in an amazing way. Unfortunately, as you said in the introduction, Banquo is one of the good guys. Unfortunately, instead of being applauded after his beautiful aria, he gets killed. So it's a very short story for Banquo. And unfortunately, we can hear just like a tad of that Verdi's beautiful writing for bass voice in this opera, but it's really, really beautiful. He has an amazing duetto with Macbeth.
Macbeth early on,
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So when Banquo and Macbeth come to the stage, they're actually like mirror reflections. And then with the prophecies told by the witches, they turn into mirror realities. Macbeth chooses one path and Banquo another one. Unfortunately, Banquo's path is really, really
short.
Well,
he does have a son, so all is not lost.
I got my song, yeah. That's
there is hope.
Yeah, yeah. There is. But the other aspect of that is, and it, I think maybe more so in the opera than in the play, I'm right in thinking this, Banquo is more than aware of what Macbeth
exactly.
is at. From that very first duet, he's saying, what's he doing here? He's been sucked in by all of this.
That's right.
Which I guess makes him more interesting.
Yeah, of course. Of course, yeah. And as you said, for the witches, I think also like with the killers of Banquo, there are like three killers, but in this opera, it's also a group of men that kind of
Yeah, because I think that the female chorus for the witches is echoed by the male chorus for the killers.
Sicari.
It's not just
assassins.
Three assassins.
No, it's a group of assassins. And that also is much more powerful than if you just had three. It gives a...
Exactly.
And it's all so quiet. You hear the way they creep in, the music. Mm. And he's already, I think, done the scene for us in many ways.
Yeah. However, Banquo does have a beautiful aria. So let's have a listen to it. And I did cut out, there's a bit of recitative at the top, but it's really when the beautiful melody starts, I thought we should pick it up from there. Unfortunately, it's the recitative that we have there rather than the aria itself. I'm tempted to ask you to continue on with the Banquo role there, but you have been rehearsing all day, so that would be a little unfair, Goran, at this point, would it?
Well, life is unfair. Come dal ciel precipita l'ombra più sempre oscura. In notte uguale and that's where we stop.
Hey, bravo!
We're keeping the tension.
Let us be very clear that that was not rehearsed. That was not expected or arranged beforehand. So to pick it up like that is quite the feat indeed, Goran. And I know you have another little surprise for us later on, which might surprise the listeners as well. We get a sense of that. There's a wonderful darkness in that. I mean, he knows. I think Banquo pretty much knows what's coming very soon after. He has the little son Fleance with him, who he gets to disappear. The backdrop of the castle and the kind of the way you're realising that in terms of the set and the setting, Sarah, just give me a bit about that.
Yeah, so when the festival came to me to say that this was the opera they wanted to do, I thought it was a fantastic choice to do it on the grounds of the castle. So it's within the grounds and we see the castle as a backdrop to the setting. And we have really taken that and tried to incorporate the surroundings of the castle. So even some of the use of floral and fauna that we're going to try fit in, and to use the space that is already there to give us the setting for which we have the opera on. So, yeah, I think it'll be a great use of the space, and I'm hoping to surprise people and that they'll really enjoy what we make of it.
And what kind of challenges does that give to you and the orchestra and the chorus and indeed Goran and the other singers, Killian?
Well, it is difficult because my home as an opera conductor normally is in a pit in front of the stage looking at all the singers. And sometimes they look at me. That's also an advantage. but of course, in the castle, we will be tucked away in the corner in, I think, what's an old stable yard, which is sort of built up to sort of act as the orchestra pit. But I will have my back to the singers. They will have some monitors to
see
look
what
at me,
you're doing,
but that does present challenges, which we will surely overcome.
Yeah. And you haven't been in the grounds of the castle yet, or down there yet, have you, Goran?
I haven't been there yet. Yeah, I'm totally looking forward to seeing for the first time.
But clearly the vocal rehearsals from what you've just done, the vocal rehearsals and everything else have been going well. In so
honestly,
far.
I like singing open air.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to singing there. It's going to be definitely like a tricky situation to not having the orchestra and the conductor on the usual spot. But also it's a very, very kind of exciting situation.
It's a challenge, but it provides us with something else. Now, I have all the details here, but I believe you have something you wanted to say to everybody first, Goran. Yeah?
We would like to invite all the audience on 31st May.
But you have a particular way you want to do that, I think, don't you?
Cade mille folce, huigan ie oscalce, eren trochach cade lo de mi bialtne I lismore.
Well, that is singing and Irish all in the one night.
Linguistic firework.
So you'll be performing part of it in Irish, obviously, as well. That's great to hear. No,
you don't have to say everything now. You really let's keep some surprises.
Absolutely. Well, listen, thanks to all three of you for coming, and particularly Goran for both your couple of focal gaeilge and that wonderful singing that you gave us totally unasked for and unprepared earlier on. Thank you so much. Sarah Baxter, Killian Farrell and Goran Urich. Macbeth will be at the Lismore Castle in County Waterford as part of the Blackwater Valley Opera Festival. It takes place, as you heard there, from the 29th of May to the 5th of Bealtaine, the 5th of June 2023. Full details on blackwatervalleyopera.ie. The saxophone is an instrument that you probably wouldn't associate with classical music, probably far more with jazz music. Rarely heard in front and centre in the classical music repertoire, but Jess Gillam, one of Britain's most acclaimed young musicians, is changing all of that. She was the first saxophonist to reach the finals of the BBC Young Musician of the Year, the youngest ever soloist to perform at Last Night of the Proms from the Albert Hall, and the first saxophonist to sign to the great classical music label, Decca. As a musician, Jess Gillam's music straddles various forms beyond classical music. Together with her ensemble, she has brought her own interesting stamp to tunes as diverse as from people as diverse as Thom Yorke and Bjork, or Bjork, as I believe I should call her. The Jess Gillam Ensemble are in Ireland right now performing in the West Wicklow Chamber Music Festival. They performed there last night, in fact, at the Salon in Rossborough House. And tomorrow evening, Saturday, they will be at the Tramway Theatre in Blessington for another show. But Jess is with me in studio this evening. Is it fair? Does the saxophonist, or the saxophone as an instrument, Jess, does it often just get... No, that's for jazz and it's not for anything else. Is it a real battle outside of the classical music world itself? Is it a real battle to persuade people of its other possibilities and its versatility?
Yeah, I think sometimes it can be. I think it's seen as an instrument that belongs in a particular sphere. Mm. And it was designed originally as a military instrument to be a loud outdoor instrument by Adolf Sachs. And then jazz kind of adopted it and it grew up there. It has its roots and its history there. But I think that we should honour that. You know, that's where it came into popularity. But there's so much more scope with it. It's such a varied sound.
And what sent you to the saxophone? I mean, did you the classic route, I suppose, for a woodwind player of any kind is to start on the recorder and then they grow up into one of the other instruments. How was it for you?
I started in a carnival band, like samba type music.
All right. Yeah, playing saxophone.
Yeah, picked it up when I was 7 and fell in love with it. And then I sort of discovered classical music when I was about 11 or 12, and then started playing written music rather than by ear.
Yeah, and at that point, did you go searching for what is the repertoire for my instrument? Which of these saxophones, by the way, do you play? Which, or do you play across the range, soprano, tenor, alto, whatever?
Yeah, I play soprano and alto mainly. A little bit of tenor, but not very often.
Yeah, and so the soprano and alto are the kind of the higher of the
ones.
Two.
Yeah.
And the soprano in particular, I suppose, shaped more like a clarinet in that it's straight out in front of you for the most part.
Yes.
The alto shaped more like the traditional saxophone.
Yeah.
So did you when you chose the saxophone and came out of your carnival band, your samba band, were you frustrated by not being able to find repertoire, or how was that? What was that experience?
No, I think not growing up in a kind of classical music arena or household, or kind of thinking what music do I play? I just would pick up anything and everything, whether it was written for the saxophone or not. It kind of didn't occur to me that was what I would look for, pieces that were written for the instrument. And then the pieces that I did find, some of them I loved and went on to play like different concertos and different pieces specifically for the instrument. But it was always an exciting thing that new music could be written for it as well.
All right. Let's have a listen. Now, you have an album, you and your ensemble. How fluid a collection of players is your ensemble?
So right now it's a group of 8 and we're pretty solid, 8 of us. So it's string quartet, percussion, piano and bass. But sometimes we'll be in smaller formations. Like last night was a trio with Sam Becker and Leif Kenny Lidstrom. And then that was piano and bass. But sometimes it'll be all 8 of us. So it's a little bit fluid.
Yeah, but it's the octet that are performing essentially on the album. Tell me a bit about the track Orbit, which I particularly like.
Oh, yeah, Orbit. So it was written for us by Will Gregory, who's one half of Goldfrapp, and he's also a saxophone player. And I asked if he'd like to write a piece. And he wrote this piece originally, like inspired by the things that just go round and round, orbiting this bass riff that you hear on the marimba first and then transfers to all the instruments, just goes circling right around.
This is then a little section from Orbit. There we go. That's the opening of Orbit from Jess Gillam and her ensemble. And even as you're listening to that, Jess, I can't believe it. Oh, very hard listening to yourself. You're already giving out to yourself about something in the recording, are you? Or just that it's moved on from that?
Yeah, I just wish you played things differently. Kind of like, yeah. Because it's crazy because you always record an album before you go and tour it. And then when you tour it, you add things, you play things differently, you shape it. But then you wish you could go back and then record that again.
Yeah, but it does strike me that, particularly that Will Gregory piece, it does do exactly what you spoke about, what you like about the saxophone itself, that you're not ignoring its kind of jazz, well, its military origins, and then that taking over in the jazz world. But then its classical possibilities. It's perfect there, but I do note that the first notes we hear are from a marimba, which of course is a percussion instrument. You know where I'm going. And your dad was a percussion teacher. Is that your little nod? Okay, Dad, I know I didn't take up percussion, but yeah, hey, you're the first one on this track.
Well, it's funny because he was a drummer, like indie rock drummer.
Yeah, so not a marimba player.
Not marimba. But yeah, I tried that and my coordination did not allow me to play the drums. It didn't happen.
It just didn't eat. Well, you know, there's a certain amount of the different type of coordination, I guess, in terms of the saxophone stuff. I mentioned about the youngest ever performer at the last night of the proms and the first saxophonist to do so many things. The recording contract and that signing up with the label, with the Decca label, how did that come about and how important is that for you to be able to disseminate the music in the way you can with a label like that?
Yeah, I signed, I think, when I was about 18 or 19 after being part of BBC O Musician of the Year. And it's really interesting working with a label because there's so many things to balance. You've kind of got their views on the kind of music that might be able to work well, and then to balance that with your own wishes and what you want to do. It was kind of, it's been, and I'm still learning, a kind of masterclass in figuring out the kind of music that you want to play and what you want to say. And like, that's a constant thing, I think, as a musician, is trying to figure out what it is you want to say to an audience and share with them.
I wonder, in terms of the way you present concerts, because you've obviously, you're a great communicator. We can hear that in terms of just speaking to you. Do you present the concerts in that style of way? Do you talk about the music as much as just the next piece is?
Yeah, I always give a story, and sometimes I think I really should talk less, because once I've got going, I just love it. I love kind of gelling with people, seeing how they react, and you can do that with a microphone or with the music. And to make it an experience, I think that can, we hear so many people talk about like taking down the barriers and stuff like that, but I don't even think it's that. I think it's just, we're in this experience together. When an audience come and watch, we're there sharing that night together. We can just make it as enjoyable as it can be.
Okay, so tell me the story that I need to hear before I listen to your version of Björk's Venus as a Boy.
No, Venus as a Boy. Well, Björk was probably one of the first singers or artists I can remember loving when I was younger. Hearing the kind of crazy voice that she has that seems to be sometimes human, sometimes not. And there's a bit in this song that she sings, I thought, I have to try and emulate that on saxophone, and spent hours kind of listening to her, trying it on the saxophone, listening again. And it's an arrangement by John Metcalf.
Okay, well, we'll have a listen to that, and I'll give people out the details of both the album itself and, of course, the performance tomorrow night, isn't it?
Tomorrow night. Yeah.
I'll give people full details of that. But thanks for coming in to speak with us, Jess. And let's have a listen to Jess Gillam and her ensemble with Björk's Venus as a Boy. Beautiful stuff indeed. That's Jess Gillam and her version of Venus as a Boy by Björk, and that is from their current album. I'm going to be playing a big chunk of that now on Sunday afternoon on the programme on Lyric for sure, because I want to listen to more of that, and if you want to hear more of it, tune in on Sunday afternoon. However, Jess Gillam, you can see her and the Jess Gillam Ensemble tomorrow evening, 8 p.m. at the Tramway Theatre in Blessington. That's part of the West Wicklow Chamber Music Festival, and as she told us, the ensemble comprises Jess herself, along with the Strim Quartet, which is Ciara McCabe, Michael Jones on violins, Owen Schmidt-Martin on viola, Gabriella Swan on cello. Bass is played by Sam Becker. Leif Kanner Lundstrom is on piano, and Elsa Bradley is the percussionist. You'll find out full details of that gig tomorrow night on westwicklowfestival.com. And so to albums as usual at this point on a Friday evening, and at 81 and still crazy after all these years, Paul Simon releases Seven Psalms, which he says came to him in a dream. Lewis Capaldi, who saw another surge in sales following his Netflix hit show Lewis Capaldi How I'm Feeling Now, releases an album called Broken by Desire to Be Heavenly Sent. Nice snappy title, that one. And Kesha's Gag Order is the fifth and final album with the record label she has waged ongoing verbal and legal war against. Dave Hanratty, Aoife Barry have been listening to the three albums and they are with me in studio now. Let's start with Paul Simon and Seven Psalms. I don't know how where you start to even summarise Paul Simon's career, Aoife, but here he is at 81. Still knocking it out.
Absolutely. And there's a video, if people haven't seen it, of him on YouTube where he's talking about the making of this album, Seven Psalms, and how the idea came to him in a dream, like you were saying, and how he'd wake up every morning at, you know, for a couple of weeks at 3 a.m, 5 a.m, and write down the lyrics. And you look at the video and like he's 81 years old and he's still hopping around the place and he's still so engaged. And it just shows, you know, we were talking about Side Myself and Dave about how creativity, just being this kind of lifelong thing, it doesn't die at a certain time, it stays with you. And he's had such a long career, like since he was a teenager, he's been writing and making music. He is just an absolute icon of a songwriter. And
to you mean hear Simon and Garfunkel?
Simon and Garfunkel and his solo stuff, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, what family in Ireland hasn't many of his albums in their record collections. But this is really interesting because instead of having this really kind of full sound, which he had in his last album that was of new stuff, Stranger to Stranger in 2016. This is really stripped down. It's 33 minutes. It's 7 songs that are meant to be listened as one whole piece, kind of one suite. And it's him, acoustic guitar, and a few instrumental and vocal bits. But essentially, it's really, really kind of stripped down in acoustic, which is really interesting.
Seven Psalms, Dave. What kind of world are we in? What I suppose, liturgical world are we in with Seven Psalms? It's a very liturgical title.
Yeah, I mean, this wasn't quite as faith-inspired as I thought it would be. I mean, like, kind of going into it. And I was quite intimidated going into this record as well because, again, the back catalogue, the legacy, the career, the man himself.
Ladysmith, Black Mambosa, Graceland in the 80s. Mm. And then, you know, what do you want? Sound of Silence, The Boxer, You Can Call Me Al, whatever you want. You know, the list just goes on, doesn't it?
Yeah, but it was the intimacy of this that really appealed to me because it does feel like you're in the room with him. It does feel like you're there watching him perform. And he's having a conversation with you. And the conversation is very stark in some ways because it is very much him staring down mortality and kind of staring death in the face and kind of having those conversations and asking those questions that are kind of unanswerable and difficult. But he does it with such a deft touch. And I was listening to this record in the same week that legendary filmmaker Martin Scorsese gave an interview in which he said at 80 years of age now, he laments that there's not enough time left to make all the more movies he wants to keep making and how he sees the world in a different way. It's opened up to him in a different perspective that he never thought he would have, and he just wishes he had more time. And I kind of got this as well from Paul Simon, but at the same time, it didn't feel downbeat to me. Mm-hmm. It felt like there was a kind of a beautiful acceptance in it, and also, look what I can still do.
Yeah. I'm going to listen to a little bit of the, because you can't call it the opening track, because it's on, it's down in there as a single. You're supposed to listen across all seven, but obviously we can't do that. But to give you a flavour of, this is the opening section, and this does have certainly some kind of religious connotation within it, because he's addressing the Lord at the very start.
I've been thinking about the great migration. Noon and night they leave the flock.
So that's from the opening section of Paul Simon's Seven Psalms, where he's giving his various versions there, Aoife Barry, of what the Lord is to him. And it's quite a pantheistic type of style. It's certainly not a feel of organised religion off what he's singing about there.
No, it's like spirituality, but at the same time, as someone myself who's not a religious person, I didn't feel like I was having religion imposed on me or anything like you were suggesting there exactly on that record. And he kind of moves to different ideas through it because he is talking about that spiritual element that we're talking about, and then he is talking about age, and he talks about a great migration, and you're not too sure if he's actually talking about it or using it as like some sort of a metaphor to refer to people passing on to the, do we know, whatever world people think we go to or not. And I think towards the end of the album, the religious-y kind of a spirituality element does come back up again. I think the last word on the album is Amen, and he's singing with Edie Brickell, his wife, who sings with him on a couple of them of moments or songs on this record, which is really beautiful. And I think, you know, like Dave was saying, even though you could say, oh, he's 81 now and it's got to be his swan song, it really doesn't have a very sad feel. it has an intimate feel to it. And I felt really emotional listening to it, thinking about his career and thinking about one day he won't be around. I had a bit of a cry earlier today. I just thought, oh, I just love Paul Simon so much. And I think you just have to be in the mood, though, to understand what he wants out of you. And just to sit down and pay attention to his record.
And I guess it is a song, an album, a cycle, whatever you want to call it, Dave, that would benefit from quiet room, headphones, late in the evening, sit and listen to what's been sung, not just musically, but lyrically.
Oh, 100%, yeah. I mean, I found myself on my travels listening to this on a packed bus in a busy coffee shop, and I had to put the volume at full volume, and I was like, I'm sorry, Paul, I know I'm not giving you what you want here. But then later in the evening at night, you know, kind of when dusk has settled, there is a gorgeous kind of feeling to this. And I do think as well, in the age of the album, when, you know, it's so pick and choose and it's all a bit streaming, it's nice to have an album that asks you for a bit of patience and rewards you with that.
Yeah, definitely. Well, let's listen to towards the end of the cycle then, or of the piece of the work that is Seven Psalms, a section called Wait. And this features Edie Brickell. They're singing together here. It's really hard to stop that, because you just want to listen to the way the music and the voices melds together so beautifully. I was saying as we were listening to that, Aoife, it does start the album with the Lord that we heard at the beginning. It is just him and the guitar, but it builds instrumentally and in terms of texture the whole way through to the final piece.
Yeah, it does. You have some strings, you have some wood instruments, you have some voices, but nothing's overplayed or like slapped onto it. Everything's so thoughtful, and you can see it in those videos of him in the studio, a little bit of thought gone into every single little thing. And it's so emotional just the more you think about the significance of this record, I think, and what he's trying to say in it. And he described it as an argument with himself, which I thought was really interesting. Yeah. So yeah, it's
wait,
beautiful.
I'm not ready, I'm just packing my gear, he says there. It's extraordinary lyric, isn't it?
It just knocks you out, and you have that kind of push-pull there. It's almost a conversation between him and Edie Brickell. And, you know, if you want to get into the whole time thing there, I mean, she is younger, so you wonder if there's any kind of idea about trying, like, putting him towards a level of acceptance. But the fact that he's showing defiance, he's showing courage, he's talking about, it's a king surveying his kingdom, and he does it in such a way that is like deft and delicate. And I do think that thoughtful is the perfect word to use for it, because it's such a statement at this stage of his career that he didn't need to make, but he's giving it to people and to himself, and I really admire that.
Yeah, it seems almost crass to talk about stars. We know he gets 5 stars for his career, although some might argue about Graceland. Let's put that to the one side for the time being. What are you saying? And this one, Dave?
It's a 4 from me. I thought it was a really, really interesting piece of work and carried off quite beautifully.
And Aoife?
Yeah, 4 stars for me as well.
So pretty solid stuff for both of you there, Paul Simon and Seven Psalms. Let us move on to Lewis Capaldi, Broken by Desire to be Heavenly Sent. As I say, it doesn't quite trip off the tongue, but then again, his first album title didn't trip off the tongue either, Aoife.
No, I mean, I'm trying to remember what the name of the record is, but I do know it has a lot of words in it. He's someone who, Lewis Capaldi is kind of a gas case in that, like, he is an absolute character. You know, he's a young Scottish guy. He spent a lot of time plying his trade, playing in pubs, and really put in, like, you know, the hours, and somehow just became this humongous star, sells out arenas, sold something like 10 million copies of his debut record. People love him. And yet his music isn't that extraordinarily unusual or different. And I can't say I would have listened to this record at all if we hadn't been asked to.
Divinely uninspired to a hellish extent.
That's why I can't remember the name of that record.
Off the tongue title of the first album. Let's have a listen to, doesn't matter which one I take here. I'm going to take Wish You the Best. Poor old Lewis. He must have the most broken heart in the world, it has to be said. Here's a song called Wish You the Best.
I miss knowing what you're thinking and hearing how your day has been. Do you think you can tell me everything, darling, but leave out every part about him?
Oh, my heart is broken. My heart is broken into tiny shards listening to Lewis Capaldi. And I don't want to be cynical about that, because the truth of the matter is, if you were at that point in, you know, an important relationship that ended, he's probably singing what a lot of people feel at that moment in time.
This is the thing. I mean, tears all over the studio, of course. I mean, like, he's very good at what he's very good at. And the contradiction between his personality, which is extremely exuberant, the wit of those album titles. Mm. I've interviewed Lewis a few times, and he is wild. He's a quote machine. He's so self-deprecating, so funny. He could be a stand-up comedian if he wants to, but there's clearly more money in this. But he said it himself. He said on this, about this album, I don't want to create a new sound for myself or reinvent myself. The songs I want to write are emotional songs about love or loss. And so you get these repetitive kind of conveyor belt torch anthems that people can say, well, you know, I got broken up with last week and this is my song, Lewis Has My Back.
Yeah.
And we were kind of saying there, we're like, he is quite a young fellow. Like, he's about 24. And I'm like, man, you know, it's only going to get...
What have you been through?
Yeah, like it's only going to get harder from here, Lewis, you know, like, God bless you. Yeah. But I mean, it is wild because it is very kind of stock and standard at times in terms of the music itself. And, you know, he's got the wounded voice down for sure, but he does sound like a kind of a hybrid of Dermot Kennedy and Niall Horan, with whom he's very good friends, and a bit of Ed Sheeran in there as well. This stuff sells massively,
yeah,
but there's not a lot of invention to the music.
And I'm not hearing from either of you any kind of cynicism around that, because there's often the question then is, how sincere is he in all of this, or is he just going, cha-ching, I know how this works, but I'm not smelling that off either of you.
It's actually kind of hard to review this album in a way, because it could be very tempting to be really mean about it because of the type of music it is, but because he comes across as a very genuine guy, and you just get the feeling like he just loves playing the guitar. He's been playing it since he was a kid in the kitchen at home. He loves writing songs. These are the kind of songs he loves writing, and people love listening to them. But it's really hard to be cynical, because you feel the genuine love that he has for his career. It's interesting though to see people he's been writing with on this record. You know, he wrote one song, Pointless, which is a single that I think went straight to number one, with Steve Mac, Johnny McDade from Snow Patrol, and Ed Sheeran. So again, like Dave was saying, you know, he's got interesting characters there that he works with. But the song that really stood out for me was one he wrote with Max Martin, I believe, called Leave Me Slowly,
where they kind of
rip off Phil Collins a little bit. Not rip off, but they're, they get a bit of inspiration from some drums by from In the Air Tonight, I think, by Phil Collins. So stars, and that's different.
Yeah, stars from you, Aoife.
2.5.
Okay. And one thing that I did notice is there are a number of explicit tracks across the album. Now I'm going to turn into his dad. Of course. And because I just thought, you don't need to be using rough language in the midst of all of this. The songs can carry without it.
I mean, listen, he's Scottish, mate. I mean,
and also, a bit of a Scottish accent we were saying just in that last song, yeah?
And again, when I've interviewed him before, like, that transcript was full of expletives. So it comes very, very naturally to him. But yeah, it's also a 2.5 for me, because I just can't really get on board with the music. But there is a ton of goodwill for Lewis. I think he's a cool guy. Yeah, and like, we are rooting for the man, but it's kind of just going to be this album over and over again. I'm sorry. That's the future career right there.
Yeah. Okay. But as I say, hard to dislike him. So 2.5. It gets it. It's getting the full 5 if you add the two of you together, I suppose.
Out of 10.
He's a 5-star man. You know?
Yeah. Oh, well, that's very well recovered, Dave. All right, let's move on to album number 3 then. Certainly a provocative title, this one, Gag Order. It may or may not refer to her ongoing battle with her ex-producer, Dr. Luke. She had dropped the dollar sign from the S in her name. She's now K-E-S-H-A, as opposed to K-E dollar sign A. So without landing us in any kind of trouble, what has been going on in that area of things, Aoife?
Yeah, so Kesha was somebody who appeared in the noughties. She was really brash, kind of pop star, had a song called TikTok that was absolutely massive at the time. But she ended up having a court case with Dr. Luke, her producer. She lost the court case. She accused him of a number of things, and then he accused her of defamation in return. Been a really difficult time for her, because she hasn't been able to talk about that case because of all the legal stuff. So hence, I think, the title, Gag Order, of this album. She doesn't really go into any specific details on it. This is more, though, about emotionally how she's been dealing with the impact of this, you know, everything that's been going on, and talking about kind of spiritual breakthroughs and, you know, the kind of psychedelic experiences and things like that. So she's really processing. And Rick Rubin is a producer, and he's really, I think, helped her do some interesting things on
this
record.
All right, well, let's listen to a track which has a metaphorical and a literal aspect to it, in its title, Eat the Acid. So you get a sense, Dave, even in listening to that little section from Eat the Acid and Kesha's new album, Gag Order,
there's depth in this. There's a lot more than just, they are pop songs, but there's more than that going on.
I love the tone of this record. We talked about the Lewis Capaldi thing and like going in with cynicism. I mean, with Lewis's album, with all due respect to him, I was like, I knew what I was going to get. With this one, I thought I knew what I was going to get. And very quickly, I realized, wait a minute, no, I'm wrong. This is actually, there's a great deal of substance here. I love the abstraction of the music in it as well. And I found myself thinking of artists like St. Vincent and Halsey, Fiona Apple even at times. I mean, this is decidedly darker than some of her kind of pop contemporaries and worlds away from, as Aoife mentioned, the brash kind of party all night gal that burst onto the scene with TikTok in 2009. This is a mature record. And like I know this comes up all the time on Arena, but like, you know, and the most personal album, that's not in the press release, but this
but it is that.
It is. And it unavoidably is based on what she's gone through in her life. And I got to say fair play to her because she's channeled it so, so well into the music. And in Rick Rubin as well, a producer who some people say does nothing and some people say does everything, his presence has helped this massively. From start to finish, this really captivated me. And I think it's an incredible statement at this stage of her career when she could have just kind of shied away. She could have been broken by the experience that she's had with the music industry, but this felt like kind of taking power back and doing it with a really compelling pop record.
Well, it is that thing of good production is actually invisible, and therefore it is nothing and everything all at the same time, isn't it? Stars, what is this one doing? It sounds as if it's doing well for you, Dave.
3.5, and I will be sticking with it. I was really impressed by it.
Right, and you're looking forward to the artist that's starting to emerge now.
I hope so. I hope she continues down this path because it's quite fruitful.
Yeah. Hey, Aoife?
Yeah, I'm going to give 3 stars and noted as well that there's no autotune on this record. And I think it's her first record that she didn't use autotune on, which I think says a lot about her progress.
When you hear her voice there, you say, why were you using it in the
first
place?
So interesting, isn't it? Yeah. So 3 stars.
And we do have to thank Rick Rubin for either she persuaded him or he.
I think he did from what she was saying in interviews. Right. Yeah.
Okay, there we go. So what did you say? Sorry, Aoife, what did you say in terms of
3 stars?
3 stars. Yeah. So pretty even Stevens for Kesha and Gag Order, Lewis Capaldi and Broken by the Desire of Heavenly Scent, and Paul Simon's 7 Psalms from Dave Hanratty and Aoife Barry. But coming to the end of our reviews a little bit earlier than usual tonight, because we're going to go out on a special track. Many of my colleagues have done today. We're going to finish up the programme in that way, marking the death of the Smiths bass player Andy Rourke at the young age of just 59. Johnny Marr made the announcement today. Obviously, in some ways, Aoife, Andy Rourke was overshadowed by the figures of Morrissey and Johnny Marr, but you can't underplay what he did, what his talent and what he did for the Smiths.
Yeah, a lot of people saying today, you know, that the rhythm section in Smiths was kind of criminally undersung because Morrissey is such a big front man and then Johnny Marr would be kind of second to him. But yeah, absolutely. And his bass lines were really melodic. When you listen back to the Smiths, that was the key. You know, they weren't these kind of really strict or boring bass lines. They were just gorgeous and they really helped that Smiths sound become like...
Yeah, it was Matt Osman of Suede who mentioned that specifically. That Andy Rourke is a bassist. You know it's him when you hear him.
Totally, yeah. Yeah, and you know, it's so interesting because they always have the contrast between these like intellectual and very emotional lyrics and then these like songs you can dance to and cry to at the same time. Very sad, only 59, and you know, had a tough life. There was court cases involved over royalties involving him and Mick Joyce, and then his relationship with Morrissey broke down as well, which is not an unusual thing in that band. And you know, he had heroin addiction at various times during his life, so he was somebody who was super talented but did also, you know, have tough times. But really interesting guy, and there's some really interesting interviews out there from maybe the 2000s that are worth reading as well, I think, about his experience in the band and kind of the aftermath and moving to New York and maybe not a very great time.
And Dave, I suppose he did play with Sinead O'Connor along the way as well. The Smiths, you know, we're talking live performances in terms of Andy Rourke. He was a big driver in that respect.
They had an incredible sound. He was a huge part of it. He was hugely influential for other musicians as well. And the Smiths sound is kind of cavernous and beautiful. You mentioned Sinead O'Connor. He also worked with Dolores O'Riordan. And again, I mean, there are tributes flying in left, right and centre as they should be. But I actually thought Morrissey's eulogy was quite beautiful. It floored me. If I could just read a quick thing from it. He said, "Sometimes one of the most radical things you can do is speak clearly. When someone dies, out come the usual blandishments, as if their death is there to be used. I'm not prepared to do this with Andy. I just hope wherever Andy has gone that he's okay. He will never die as long as his music is heard. He didn't even know his own power, and nothing he had played had been played by someone else. His distinction was so terrific and unconventional, and he proved it could be done." And he closes by saying, "I suppose at the end of it all, we hope to feel that we were valued. Andy need not worry about that."
Wow, that is quite the dedication. Let's finish then by listening to from side 2 of The Queen is Dead, The Boy with the Thorn in His Side.
Thorn in his side, behind the hatred there lies a murderous desire for love.
Beautiful stuff indeed. The Boy with a Thorn in His Side from The Smiths, and that's remembering Andy Rourke, who has died at the age of just 59. And that brings Friday evening's arena to a close. Paula Shields and Leah Murphy researched. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. Ruth Kennington was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you on Sunday on Lyric between 1 and 4. And back with you on Monday as usual at 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. Rick Cuddihy will be with you after the news.